There are still people walking in, so we're just waiting a few more minutes. Good morning. We have decided to start. There are still many name tags still out on the table, but we're assuming that people will arrive late and then just join us whenever they come. I think I will still close the door, though. I'm closing the door, but you can let people in when they come. We'll wait for Cecil to join. Okay. All right. Welcome. My name is Kristin Skinstad van der Kooi. I've been working with the master's program in multicultural and international education since 1997. I'm very honored to have this opportunity to welcome you all to this festive occasion, as it is. we have planned a full-day seminar, which is formal, in a way, but we're also hoping to create a friendly atmosphere to celebrate the spirit of this program, and I'm sure we'll succeed doing that together. I'm very happy to see former colleagues from near and far, and colleagues we're working with presently, many students. Welcome, all of you. I will be your timekeeper today, and I will be introducing most of the speakers. I have a few practical announcements to make before we start. The seminar will be streamed. There are two cameras in the back. It will be streamed live, but I have also been told that it will be accessible later on. Toilets are outside near where the coffee table is. There will be coffee and tea served during the breaks. Welcome. We will have a light lunch served for you right outside. And after the ending of this formal program, You are invited to join us for mingling, chatting, talking, and some light refreshments after the program. There are pictures from fieldwork experiences internationally posted on the wall. And you are welcome to have a look at those during the breaks. You will also be shown many pictures during our presentation. So hopefully you'll get an impression of the diversity of all this work that's been done over the past 20 years. It's not easy to include everything and to do everything justice, but we will do try to make to convey a picture of what we have been doing. Now, first, before we start talking about our own history and so on, it's my pleasure to welcome the Dean of Education at the Faculty of Study Programs at the Faculty of Education and International Studies, and our Institute Head, Institute of International Studies and Interpreting, and that's Finn Aarsæter, the Dean, and Gunn Bjørnsen, our Head of Institute, and Jonny Aasen, who was the first leader of the Institute of International Education and Interpreting, but he was also the first graduate of the master's program. So they have joined us today to open the seminar, and I wish you welcome to join the stage, Finn first, and then Gunn. And, you know.
Thank you, Kristin. And I should correct you. I'm pro-dean of education, not dean.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay. And it's an honor for me to, on behalf of the Faculty of Teacher Education and International Studies at HiWA, to wish you all welcome to the 20th anniversary of the Master's Program in Multicultural and International Education, or the MIE program, as it also is called in Norwegian. I feel certain that there will be several others illuminating different aspects of the MIE program during the day. I will confine myself to highlighting some of the impact that the Master's program has had on our faculty during the last 20 years. First of all, it should be stated that establishing a master's program at the university college level was not at all usual at the time the MIE started up. Actually, the MIE master was the only program available for school teacher students who wanted to proceed to the master's level at our faculty for quite a long period. There are, of course, efforts at several levels when a master program is established, but a crucial one is the academic initiative and stamina necessary to carry through such a plan. It's always a risky business to mention individuals in such contexts, but I don't think I'm wrong when pointing at Professor Anders Breile and former rector at HiWA, Sissel Østberg, as being central architects behind the MIE project. Based on their initiative, teacher education at HiWA has built educational competences and research competences in the fields of international education and intercultural understanding. The international students at the international part of the master's program represent in itself a valuable resource to the faculty student population. Furthermore, the comparative approach to education broadens the horizon of our own teacher education and the educational practices carried out in Norwegian kindergartens and schools. Norway has always been a multicultural society, but diversity has been highly reinforced through migration to the country, especially in the years after 1970. The MIE Master's program represented a needed response to this, as its goal was to produce interesting and relevant education and research for a diverse Norway in the 21st century. The teacher education programs at both the Department for Early Childhood Education as well as the Department for Primary and Lower Secondary School have no doubt benefited from the work carried out at the MIE program. Yesterday we had wonderful news at Hiwa, as it became clear that the application for becoming a university was positively evaluated by the academic committee. Of course, this is due to great efforts made by all faculties and departments at Hiwa. Nevertheless, running a master's program for 20 years gives the staff good training when it comes to doing research. It's no secret that the Department of the International Studies and Interpretation at our faculty is an important engine in our research activity, and the MIA program has been part of this all the time. It's hardly incidental that the two first leaders of the faculty's PhD program, Professor Jorunn Pihl and Professor Halla Holmarsdottir, has their academic affiliations with the MIA program. I started by stating that being a 20-year-old master's program in the university college sector is quite a respectful age. On the other hand, being 20 is something we usually link to high level of energy, hunger for innovation, and a long life ahead. I even think that this is the case for the master's program in multicultural and international education, as it now undergoes changes to adjust to new times and new demands. I wish you a happy birthday, Mia. And I wish you all the best in developing new and, I'm sure, exciting programs that is felt relevant both by students and by society. Happy anniversary on behalf of the faculty.
It is a true privilege and a great pleasure for me to also be welcoming all of you to this very important celebration and anniversary. As we all know in this room, education is indeed the pillar and the core activity for all sustainable development. And throughout the years, MIA has truly, really contributed in an understanding of this in many ways. We are celebrating today a unique master program. We have educated throughout the year several hundred professionals for different positions in educational systems all over the world, in NGOs and in other sectors. We have also a well-documented success throughout the evaluations that we do at the departments. I want to point to some success factors in this. I believe that the combination of the North and the South perspectives in understanding minority and majority relations and cultural complexity in education has been a strong factor in this program. Having the different positions in understanding the similar processes, whether it is in Norway or it is in the Global South, has been a true strength of the program. I believe the composition of the student group, as we see also today, is a very important factor that we cannot see from the program descriptions itself. But of course, learning to know the different backgrounds of each other as students is really fundamental in this program. I would also say the critical perspectives in the teaching and training are crucial. Here, taken for granted understandings of education globally is really challenged, and also perspectives on indigenous knowledge is included in the curriculum. The most important, last but not least, factor is definitely the composition of the staff. We have a staff at MIA that are indeed engaged, very knowledgeable within their fields, and very sincere in their work and engaged. I would like to use the opportunity to thank each one of you, no names mentioned, for the work that you have put in this program for the 20 years that have passed. It is so important and vital. As Finn was mentioning, we are also looking forward at this day, and there are some changes going on that I believe will be to the good. There will be a possibility for specialization also in development from the next study year, and the north part of the MIA program will make a pillar also in a new master degree that we will offer from 2019. At the moment, we can look forward to a fantastic day. It's really a welcome host program we have to look forward to, both bringing in student perspectives, many of the staff's perspectives, as well as people having traveled both far and not so far. And I would like to thank you all, contributors, for attending and contributing to this day. Finally, I wish you all welcome again, and a big congratulations to MIA 20 years.
Okay, thank you for the invitation. It's 20 years ago. At that time, I sat in Tanzania. I worked as a head of department at teacher training school there, college, maybe, was not sure what I was going to do when I was growing up. So I was at that time looking for a new future, maybe after these 2 years in Tanzania, where I have learned a lot about education in Tanzania, education and the I always compare the education in Norway and Tanzania. So I wanted to write about these things and my experience there. So then I started looking for education, who could fit that in Norway. And during July 95, I saw an announcement in a newspaper at the embassy of Dar es Salaam. It was before internet time, so it was not at that time at all relevant to look at internet. I mean, this was total another time. I saw this announcement, and but the pity was that it was too late to send the application. So I called Asle Høgmo, who at that time was the leader of the master. He was appointed to lead this. And I sent I called him, and he said to me, "Oh, you can just send and submit an application, and I think it will be okay." Of course, I had told him about my experiences and what I wanted to do, and so on. And so I was this master course started before I came. But yes, as you all know now, that I passed as the first, in fact, after two years. And for this, I really and I met some very impressive teachers there. You can see them here. Ellen, Kristin, Jorun. I didn't meet Anders. I will come back to that. I met George as well. And I met Sissy Lester. And later on... about 10 years later, I saw a new announcement about an position of head of this master. And I said to myself after 10 years as a leader at the Rosenhof Voksenopplæring Center, maybe I should apply for this. So I did, and I got the position. And then I met Anders Breili. And then, yes, we had a long history together, and he was the, I think we can call him the founder of this, together with Sissel, this study. So it's really, I think for me it has really been a good study, and for also for many students. I think it's more than 200. And I also think that this study will be very relevant in the future. A study like this, which is very multidisciplinary and take into account the best practices and new theory, will always be relevant for this kind of studies. It will never be old-fashioned. So these days, when I'm retired, I continue with my work, which I started over this my master thesis about education in Tanzania and Norway. Okay, thank you and congratulations.
So, turn myself back on. I am just peeking at the time. Can you hear me now? Is it on? Yeah. Okay. I think we'll be chewing off a little bit of the break time, but you're going to have all the time that you were allocated anyway. Okay. I am going to walk us through the history of the program, so to speak. It will be my interpretation of it, I believe. And I will also focus a little bit more when I speak about the research profile and the developments of perspectives throughout this period of 20 years. I will speak more about the multicultural education in the North dimension of the program, more than about the South, because the education and development dimension will be covered by several speakers throughout the day. It's there is a lot to be mentioned when speaking about 20 years of intense work in this field. So, needless to say, I will be rushing through many things that would deserve more attention. I'm going to look at the establishment of the program briefly, because this has also been mentioned now by our first speakers. And when speaking about the developments, I will be focusing on internationalization of the program, internationalization at home, receiving students from the Global South, internationalization of the education, what we actually do in teaching and learning in the program, and the contributions to internationalization of HIUA. I'm also going to speak about the international program expansion and about research and development in multicultural education. So this is a lot, as you can see. The first cohort of students started in 1997, and I think I made a mistake when I introduced myself. I did not start in 1997, I started in 2000, when the first international students arrived. It coincided with that. Our first international students were so-called quota students, students who received scholarships from Norway, from the Norwegian government. We recruited two students from Bangladesh, two from Sudan and two from South Africa. We kept on receiving quota students up until the year before last year, when the quota program was ended, unfortunately. Excuse me. So we are not, at the moment, not recruiting quota students because this program does not exist anymore. But Anders Breili is very busy trying to change the politicians' minds on this, lobbying for the rebirth of the quota program, which we found was very, very successful. Our candidates emerging from this program returned, graduated on time, wrote interesting theses, did very interesting research, returned to their home countries and are contributing now in the fields of education in very important positions in other countries, as well as these three we have recruited from Ghana, from Afghanistan, from Zambia, and probably others that I am forgetting at the moment. But this has been a wonderful contribution, I think, to education in the Global South, but also, not the least, to our program here, which I will return to. In 2006, the NOMA program started, and in 2008, the NUCOP program started, and we will look at a little video to get some more information about, or to share with you what those programs were about. Like it was mentioned, the goals of this program was to develop competence for work with the Norwegian multicultural schools, as well as international education in the South. Those two dimensions have been there all along. It's also been a goal to impact teacher education, to carve out space for international and multicultural perspectives in Norwegian teacher education, and, of course, to create opportunities for education and competence development in our partner institutions and individual students and societies in the Global South. And I will get back to this point in particular towards the end. In speaking about perspectives and interests, these are some images. These were taken in the old days of analog photography. so they're scanned analog pictures. So pardon the quality. These are images showing one aspect of what was going on in Oslo in the late 1990s. In the time of the early days of this program, these are people protesting a new mandatory subject in Christianity and ethics and worldviews in the elementary schools or in elementary and lower secondary. In the late 1990s, mid 1990s, late 1990s, multicultural education was debated highly, and this is, our program grew out of this time period. There's less talk about multicultural education these days. We are now into speaking about diversity, and that's another big discussion. Now, it has been said that this master's program is unique in combining perspectives on education in the South and in the North, and I do believe it is. It gives us a unique perspectives, I think, at least when it comes to when we compare our education program to other education programs that I'm familiar with in this country. In internationalizing teacher education, and not the least through receiving international students from the Global South and exporting, so to speak, our education programs to universities in the South, we have been forced, in a sense, to face ourselves and to raise questions about the knowledge construction that we are part of, both in the North and the South. And I think the South dimension has particularly helped in promoting that. So the decolonization of the curriculum has been and is a very important dimension in our work. We do have a socio-cultural perspective on learning, socialization, and teaching, meaning that considering education as not being neutral, the content of education, of course, always cultural. The ways that we learn and teach are cultural, and this means that we need to take cultural and societal factors into consideration when planning and carrying out educational programs. One small example of what that means is that importance lies on when for example, students with minority backgrounds fail to learn as much in school as other students, the question is not what's wrong with those students, but what is wrong with our education, to put very briefly. We conceptualize and study relationships between formal education and local communities and learners using concepts like local knowledge, home knowledge, primary socialization, asking epistemological questions, examining power knowledge in the global knowledge economy, in national curricula, and in educational research. All of these cover both the North and the South dimension. We examine and discuss which knowledges count, whose knowledge counts. Indigenous knowledge and Indigenous research are important concepts which we teach both, I believe, to the benefit of students working in the South, but also in Norway. Documenting injustice in education is important, but not only that. Developing research and educational practices that can promote justice through education is important in this program. Acknowledging again that knowledge is not something that we speak about in the singular. We speak about knowledges. The research that is developed within these 20 years has been done in several countries in the South and in the North, connecting the research done by the faculty members to partnerships with institutions in the South, where we have also recruited students from, and where our master's students have traveled to do their own research for their master's theses. Students from Norway have done master's work or their field work on many occasions in the countries of home countries of the students who have come here, so that this connection between research and teaching and education has always been an integral part of this, of the development of this program. Research in Norway by faculty members has also created opportunities for master's students and PhD students to work together with the faculty. I have two pictures, again, the same bad quality, but I just needed to show you these two pictures. These are two of the first quota students who started the first year together with me. They started together with me. And this is Stephen and Joshua from Sudan, from what is now South Sudan. This is Joshua and Henrik Weigland. We traveled together to Anders cabin, Anders hytte. And we stopped in Lillehammer, of course, and we stopped in Eidsvoll. And I was just looking through my old pictures the other day, and I found these two. And I think that bringing Stephen and Joshua with us today is something that we needed to do. Stephen has unfortunately passed away. These were the first two people I ever met from South Sudan, and it changed my life forever. Okay. A list of countries where we have had students from. And I could add to this list because I know that there are, there are people who are, in a sense, representing these places that have experiences from living and working in more countries than what are listed here. So where people are, where the statistics of our archives, what they show as where you are from, doesn't necessarily say everything about where you have lived or where you have worked or where you have experience from. So I know I could add to this list. I know at least, one that I can think of. I know that there is a student who is from Iran who is working with us now, who has experience from Malaysia, for example. And there are many more examples like that. But look at this list. This is our world. Okay. We have been congratulated today on contributing to internationalizing this coming university. And I would just like to say a few words about that. Internationalization, as we know from working with this for these many years, is a lot more than administrative adjustment. It's a lot more than just teaching in English. That's where we start, recruiting people, making sure they have a place to live, making sure they understand what we say when we teach is important. That's where we start. But that is not what makes education international. So working on changing pedagogies, working on practical, on integrating the experiences of the students of diverse backgrounds, of international backgrounds, into our teaching, into our knowledge production, is what makes education international. And we have tried to contribute to this development in the college. In the beginning, there was no international office. We did all the work of receiving, the practical work of receiving international students, which was very rewarding, extremely work intensive. But as you can tell from my emotions, a very, very rewarding process. And we have tried to convey these experiences at the college through, for example, the Intercult program, where we developed programming to support international students, but not only international students, but the students in international groups, in international cohorts. So focusing not only on helping the international students, but focusing on trying to make international student groups work for everyone so that there is internationalization also for students from Norway who participate in studying with the international students. And I must say this is one of the most important and rewarding parts of our program, that students study for the whole master's program together, not in particular courses taught in English for international students who visit us for a few weeks. They may also, have their benefits. I don't mean to talk them down, but I think that these mixed groups are really important, and I think that they've taught us a lot that we have tried to convey also to the rest of this institution. Okay, I'm going to share with you just a few minutes of a video to give you a brief glimpse of what the NOMA and NUCUP programs are about. And there seems to be no sound. If there's no sound, I'm not going to bother. tested this, believe me. Give it one more try. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. Try one more time. If it doesn't work now, then... Okay. Thanks, Guru. Okay, it's not going to work. I'll try to work it in the break. We'll just continue. The NOMA program. Am I still on? Yeah. The NOMA program was a collaboration between Zambia, Sudan, South Africa, and Norway. Students traveled between these institutions and did parts of their studies in these institutions and received their master's degrees from our college. The focus of this, the program was similar to the MIA program, but the focus was on education and HIV/AIDS. We will hear more about this program later, as Professor Austin Cheka will speak about it in his presentation. NOMA collaborators. Graduation in Khartoum, they know how to do it right. Okay. I'll let you read that. And then the NUCOP program was a program for master's students in South Sudan. In this program, all the students were from South Sudan. The focus in this program was education and sustainable development in post-conflict. It started in Malakal in South Sudan, near the border of the north, but had to be moved to Juba shortly afterwards because of the conflict. This program had three components: developed and established a master's program at Upper Nile University, but which was moved to Juba. Competence building involving academic and administrative staff at both institutions. And a support for two PhD students from South Sudan, as well as research done by the faculty here. This program has been discontinued. However, there is a new master's program for South Sudanese students now in operation in exile in Ethiopia, in Hawassa. The second cohort has just started. How many students are there now altogether, Anish? 29 students. So building on the NOMA experiences, building on the NUCOP experiences, there is now, how should I put it, a third phase or a master's program in Africa for South Sudanese students going on right now. A few quotes from an evaluation from 2002, which attested to the value of teaching international students here in Oslo. And I will rush on. The same evaluation, students said that they learned these things from the program, and I'm very happy to see this list. And we have continued working on these dimensions. And they also said that we should continue, and we did. Since 2000, this was 15 years ago. Some more pictures from students' work. Students do field work and write their theses, and these are some of the pictures that they've sent us. Now, on to the multicultural part. We have been focusing our research on the relationship between the formal Norwegian school and ethnic and cultural minorities over the years. Jorunn Pihl, in the beginning of the period of this master's program, Jorunn Pihl had a postdoc fellowship where she was devoted her research time to studying to try to understand and study the mechanisms why my ethnic minority pupils were overrepresented in segregated special education programs. And this research has been and is very important in several ways, not the least in focusing attention on our profession as educators, on how do educators gain knowledge about their students? How is knowledge produced and reproduced within the professions? And how may this contribute to stigma and to marginalizing students, as well as helping them? This research has been published, has been given wide attention, and is still being debated, still being discussed. I know that Jorunn is still invited to give talks, and we will continue to talk about this for a long time. We have, I mentioned in that list of perspectives that researching about how education, how schools are unjust and reproduce injustice, it reproduce marginalization, was for a long time the main topic or the main object of study in our field. But after having worked on that for a long time, and after having read other people's research that confirm this, that education, the way we do it, continues to reproduce inequality in society, Jorunn was had enough of this and started asking questions about what can we do to change this, and bringing in more critical perspectives, more critical theory into the field of multicultural education has raised new questions, more in terms of what is it that schools do that keep reproducing these differences. And how can we contribute with theory and research and education that will actually change things? So we're asking questions now about what might be, or what could be, rather than only what do we see. And that is an exciting development. In doing this, Jorunn looked to the library sector and started working across professions in order to get a new perspective into teacher education, into educational research. And teacher education. The big project that we've been working on for 10 years is establishing and studying partnership between librarians and teachers in changing the content of education, opening up more diverse content for the diverse students that we have in the classroom. Seeing that the more traditional school book curriculum, textbook curriculum does not fit, is not a good match for many of our students. It's not a diverse curriculum for the diverse population that we have. So we have been trying to work on that, working with kids. This is what field work in Norway looks like. or could look like, can look like, working with children in a public library in Drammen. And we have taken this a little bit further. Even Jorunn has written about involving youth in research, and I've been trying it on a very small scale, involving secondary school students, lower secondary school students, in researching inclusion and exclusion in their own school. And this raised some very interesting questions about how newcomer students are included or excluded in the school environment, which was a question raised by these students themselves, and where they conducted research, and three master's students also conducted research on this topic. We had research seminars together where our secondary school students presented their research questions and got feedback from professors from the university college and developed their research in that way. And contributed to developing their school, because this the knowledge that they built was shared back to the school. So this is these are attempts to try to change the injustice that we've been documenting for decades in education. So we do try to ask the profoundly multicultural questions, and what are these? We're going to hear more about that after I can finish talking. For example, how is education financed? How much are children worth, in a sense? Which Ingvild will talk more about later. And then, of course, historicizing the debate, bringing post-colonial and historical perspectives into looking at education in Norway has been very, very valuable. These are the post-colonial perspectives, same post-colonial perspectives that are used in the study of education in the Global South. Now, one of our goals was to impact teacher education in Norway, and I'm asking this question now after 20 years. Have we impacted teacher education in Norway? Not to the extent that I would like. So how can we work on this in the future, is what I ask myself. And then I end with this to show. This is an image of our own stereotypes, and which is an image to me of this post-colonial critique that we do raise in this master's program, I believe. Turning the focus on ourselves and our stereotypes. This is a painting by Vanessa Baird, a Norwegian artist or an artist living here, called In the Mediterranean Sea, commenting on the... it's been called a caricature of our stereotypes, and trying to understand why we let this happen and why we let our politicians continue to do this. And this is very much connected with that question in education of what are our children worth? Who counts? Okay, I end with that, and we're going to change speakers now. So a couple of minutes while Ingvild gets ready. Thank you. Okay. Okay, let me introduce Ingvild Bjordal. Ingvild was a master's student at our program. She also got her teacher education at this college. When she came to study with us, she was brave enough to turn her eyes on her own teacher education program, examining multicultural dimensions in her own teacher education program. She continued her work as a teacher in Trondheim after having taught in multicultural schools in Oslo, starting noticing the differences between how two cities in Norway work with the multicultural population in education. Big differences, and that brought out some very interesting questions, which Ingvild continued to research for her PhD. And in my mind, Ingvild asks those very important, profoundly multicultural questions, and we'll hear more about that now.
Thank you. The sound is okay? Yep. Thank you. Yeah, my name is Ingvild, and I come from the Norwegian University of Science and Technology, NTNU, in Trondheim. And as Christel said, I'm a former teacher, now former student of this master program. And when you introduced your how you got to know this program, I came to remember how I got to know this program. And it was when I was working as a teacher up in the Groruddalen. And it was my first year as a teacher. And my class was a very multicultural class. And I had this praxis shock. And I didn't know really what to do and how to handle this. And one day I saw that there was some posters in the school with this announcing this multicultural international master program. And I was thinking, okay, I have to go there. But then a friend of mine who has already started this program said that there are only 16 places and half of them are going to the international students. So there's only 8 places for the Norwegian students. So I was like, okay, what to do? How to get in? So I took down all the posters on the school to make sure that I could enter the promoter program. And... So sorry about that, but I got in and I'm very pleased because it's been very important for me, this program, and especially what you referred to when you introduced the program and say what the content have been. And for me, the master's program have been very important because it's especially in the way that I was trained to the critical thinking and critical theory, and the introduction to that has been really important. So, after working as a teacher, I started my PhD, and exactly 1 year ago, 1 year and 1 day, I defended my doctoral thesis with the title Marketization in an Urban Norwegian School Context, a Social Justice Perspective. In my PhD project, I have looked at the introduction of market-oriented policies in education and how this policy are legitimized politically and realized and experienced locally. And in this presentation, I would like to present to you some of the findings from my PhD project. I started the PhD project in 2011 and I finished in 2016. And the focus of my project has been to study the consequences of what can be called internal marketization. And this is related to how ideas, techniques and practices from private sector are introduced to make public education more business-like or more like business. And in contrast to external marketization, which refers to how the education sector are being opened up to private sector and business interests, internal marketization refers to how public education is changed from within. In this context, the application of new public management techniques and measures to increase competition between schools are central. The purpose of the study has been twofold. First, it has been to gain knowledge about how marketization policies work and materialize in real school contexts. and second, to illuminate how we can understand the intention and consequences of marketization policies from a social justice perspective. And in order to do so, I based my analysis on Stephen Ball's theory of policy enactment and theory of social justice, and Nancy Fraser. My PhD project was designed as a qualitative case study, and I focused on Oslo, the municipality of Oslo. And in order to study how market-oriented policies are legitimized and realized and experienced, I have analyzed policy documents and interviewed 15 head teachers in primary and lower secondary schools in different parts of Oslo. So, my background for studying marketization in education from a social justice perspective is related to several things. First of all, it is related to that the school historically has played an important role as an arena for social integration. For more than 100 years, the political idea and strategy of what we know as enhetsskolen, or fellesskolen, have dominated educational policy thinking. And in this context, the school has been recognized as one of the most important political tools to ensure social integration. Second of all, the introduction of market-oriented policies have been said to challenge social democratic paradigm that underlies the Norwegian school model. While the social democratic school model have been characterized by strong state governance, by its social and cultural function, and by its strong community ideology, education within a neoliberal paradigm with a market as a model is characterized by increased decentralization, an emphasis on education's economic function, and understanding that education is primarily a private property. And third, international research have documented that the introduction of market-led policies in education have reinforced segregation between different groups. This is related to how measures introduced to enhance choice and competition favor already privileged groups. When I decided to look at Oslo, this is because the municipality have introduced several measures to enhance internal marketization. Features of internal marketization are deregulation, performance management, accountability, performance-related pay, competitive funding, school or parental choice, and publication of school-specific factors like performance outcomes. In the Norwegian context, we know this as decentralisering or resultatstyring, stykkprisfinansiering og fritt skolevalg, og ikke minst bruk av offentlige nettportaler. When I looked at these measures, I can find that all of these measures are introduced in Oslo, and they work today in schools. So this is the reason for looking into Oslo as a market-oriented educational context. One of the central research questions in my study have been to look at how the how internal marketization work and materialize in local settings. This means studying how the combination of the policy measures mentioned influence schools situated in different parts of the city and having different student groups. In order to study how policy is materialized, I based my analysis on Stephen Ball and his colleagues' theory of policy enactment, which is a theory of how schools do policy. A central element to this theory is the emphasis on context and agency in order to understand how policies are translated and interpreted in school. In my analysis, I have focused especially on how schools experience the combination of parental choice, or fritt skolevalg, per capita funding, stykkprisfinansiering, where the money follows the student, performance management, and publication of performance outcome and student composition on public websites. So, what does my analysis show? First of all, my analysis show that schools experience the combination of policy measures differently. That is not very surprising. But they also find that there are some local factors that are of importance for how the school experienced the combination of policy measures. The first one is the amount of ethnic minority students. The other one is the amount of pupils from social disadvantaged backgrounds. The third one is test results, and the fourth is school's reputation. Even though these are central elements, the influence of the local factors are dependent on how the school looks like in relation to the neighboring schools. In other words, the local school context are of importance. In my analysis, there are clear patterns that show how the various policy measures affect each other, but also how the combination of measures impact different schools in different ways. On this basis, I have categorized schools that seem to benefit from this policy context as privileged schools, and schools that seem to get their conditions weakened as marginalized schools. And I will now show you what characterizes the different categories of schools. Characteristic for the schools categorized as privileged and marginalized is that they have different student groups. While the privileged schools have a low percentage of ethnic minority students, marginalized schools have a high amount of ethnic minority pupils and pupils from social disadvantaged backgrounds. Among the head teachers, the schools are referred to as white and brown schools. The composition of the student groups influence the learning environment and affect the school's performances. Head teachers especially point to that the amount of pupils with need of adapted language education do affect how they perform. Privileged schools can show to higher academic performances than marginalized schools. The composition of the student group and the school performance outcomes are, according to the head teachers, of importance for schools' reputation. And statistics on both of these factors are published on public websites like minosloskole.no. So while the privileged schools are characterized by having a good reputation, the marginalized schools experience that they struggle with their reputation. Schools' reputation are again of importance for how the school experiences school choice or parental choice. While the marginalized schools experience that pupils leave school in favor of white schools or other neighboring schools, privileged schools experience the opposite. They recruit pupils from brown schools. As the schools get funded by the number of pupils, marginalized schools with a high amount of ethnic minority pupils and pupils that come from social disadvantaged backgrounds get their budgets cut, and experience unstable financial situation. This at the same time as the privileged school experience a more stable and strengthened financial situation. The financial situation influences schools' opportunities to make long-term plans, for example, in relation to the recruitment of staff. According to the head teachers, performance management means that school leaders' autonomy and room for local decision-making is dependent on their performances. While schools in both of the categories report that performance management has decreased local autonomy, marginalized schools report about more direct control and involvement than privileged schools. Head teachers in marginalized schools experience less autonomy than head teachers in privileged schools. Characteristic for how the combination of policy measures work is that they appear to produce positive and negative spiral effects. The consequence of this is that while privileged schools strengthen their position in the school market, marginalized schools experience the opposite. Within this context, head teachers across school point to that they experience an increased polarization between neighboring schools. As a consequence, this polarization goes along ethnic and social lines. And as a consequence, the schools do not necessarily reflect the population in the intake area of the school. As one head teacher say, we see that Norwegian parents or parents of second or third generation who are worried that there are too many immigrant children with little Norwegian skills at school, they are now applying other schools. And then you can see that while 80% of our students are multicultural background, the neighboring school only have 30-40% right up the street. It's such a polarization. And you see the same in the kindergarten. And another head teacher said that the neighboring schools are about to become white schools, while we are only getting browner and browner, to put it a simple way. When the school's budgets are dependent on the number of pupils, they also point to that there is an increased competition to attract students. One head teacher put it this way. We do attract students from one neighboring school, but of course we also feel that a different neighboring school is breathing us down the neck because it's a whiter school with fewer minority pupils. And in this situation, some pupils are talked about as more attractive than others. White pupils and pupils with high academic achievements are spoken of as attractive, while pupils in need of extra adjustment or resources or ethnic minority pupils are spoken of as less attractive. One head teacher say, nowadays it's all about keeping students and keeping students performing well. It's a crazy development. And another teacher referred to her own experience. I have also experienced in my time as principal head teachers who say no to students because they have a different ethnic background. Then the school is suddenly full, which really only wants to have resourceful students at her school. I think it's quite difficult as a head teacher to sit and watch, but it's actually real. But clearly, if we know that they are children with special needs, and if they also are language minority pupils, then it's a cost for the school. This is refers to what in the literature can be called cream skimming, that the school is selecting their students. The external pressure to perform in relation to standardized tests and defined objectives have influenced how head teachers facilitate teaching. In my analysis, there is clear patterns showing that head teachers working with different pupils make the same priorities when it comes to teaching practices. In this context, subjects not considered valuable in raising student performances are given low priority, while subjects and teaching methods with direct influence on students' performances are given priority. As a consequence, the teaching practice varies little according to the student group, and the practice can be described as decontextualized and uniform. So what is given lower priority are cultural activities. The head teacher said that we no longer give priority to the literature week or the theater shows and go skiing and class trips and absolutely mother tongue instruction and bilingual subject teaching is not a priority. And practical and aesthetical subjects. While traditional teaching focuses on basic subject and basic skills, prepare students for tests and standardized teaching methods are a given priority. So, my analysis show that policy measures materialized locally reveals that while some schools experience that this context gives them advantages when it comes to recruitment of pupils and economic stability, others describe the opposite effect. This contributes to a polarization between schools along ethnic and social lines of division, which affect the school's economic situation, their reputation and value in the local school market. And it also shows that performance management and accountability policies contribute to a uniform and decontextualized educational practice. One of the questions that I have asked in my project is whether marketization policies challenge school as an arena for social integration. According to Professor in Educational History Alfred Oftedal Telhaug, the Norwegian school model, with the ideal of being a school for all, can be considered to consist of four features. These features refer to strategies that have been given priority to establish a school as an arena for social integration. The first feature regards the distribution of resources in education and to which all schools should have access in equal quantity and quality of economic, material and human resources. The second feature is the social dimension, which addresses schools' ability to facilitate interaction between all groups of pupils. And the third feature is the cultural dimension that upholds that the content of the curriculum should be approximately the same for all pupils. And the final dimension concerns the respect for diversity, that equity in education requires that the teaching is adjusted to the different pupils that enter schools. If we take this dimension as a point of departure to assess whether marketization policies affect the school as an integrating, a social integrating institution, the picture, as I see it, is quite clear. Internal marketization policies implies a resource model where the premise is that schools' resources should differ according to schools' ability to attract students. Parental choice increases segregation in such a way that children with different backgrounds not necessarily go to the same school. A management by objective and results means that pupils don't meet the same content in curriculum, but that they compete and are held to the same standards. Standards that, according to the head teachers in my study, are designed in such a way that they favor minority-speaking pupils and disfavor language minority pupils. And policies that encourage a decontextualized and uniform educational practice does not take into consideration that equity in education is dependent on schools' ability to adapt teaching to the different pupils. As I see it, it is clear that marketization policies challenge school as an arena for social integration. And this is especially related to how strategies to ensure justice in distribution and mixed classes are now being replaced by initiatives to enhance individual choice and competition. And being concerned of the political will to give priority to the latter, I think it's important to question whether internal marketization contributes to an increased segregation within the frames of public education. Thank you for your attention.
Ingvild was very disciplined with the time, so I wonder, are there any questions for Ingvild? Or comments? Bob?
Yeah, just a comment. That everything you presented, Ingvild, is very much reflected in our experience in the UK. I'm a governor of a primary school there in Wales. Education is devolved locally to Wales, which is that bit of the UK on the left. It's inhabited by the Irish who couldn't swim, is what they said. But we even have gone to the extent where schools are classified as green schools, yellow schools, amber schools, and red schools. And you can imagine what that means, that green schools are outstanding, excellent, whatever terms you want, and then down the scale to the red school, which is failing and in danger. And you can also guess what the population of that school is. There's also a massive, massive focus on performance criteria a lack of trust in head teachers and teachers. Everything is systematized and marketized, as you've indicated. I just wanted to say that you are not alone in this struggle.
Okay. Now just one, I think this was a very, very... Yeah, okay. I think this was a very interesting and illuminating lecture. And I was wondering, have you been able to communicate this to the politicians in Oslo? Have you written an article about this in one of the main newspapers? Because this is extremely important when we now hear about this segregation, the establishment of gangs in the eastern part of Oslo and so on. This is something that the politicians need to hear about.
Thank you. Yes, as part of my PhD, I went to London, and talking with people, looking at the same thing, and they told me the same as you that, what you see, we have already seen here. Yeah. I think we have adopted your. Yeah, and how do I communicate this to them? Communicate my what I found. What I noticed when I finished this is that there is a massive interest in the this kind of topic. And from politicians and from the academic environment. And I was invited to come to speak to the educational authorities here in Oslo to present what I have found and to discuss with them. And so that is how I have talked about it, and I also written in the newspaper. But when I met the politicians, they asked me, "Yeah, we know that this is going on, but what do you think we should do about it?" And I was like, "Well, it's a really big question because it's also a question that doesn't only. It's not all about." Education is also about social policies and where, how we live, housing policies. So I think it's a bigger question than only education. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Ingvild. We'll have I'll shorten the break till 10 minutes. So we'll start again at 11:05. Thank you.